it'll be first and 25.
This is First and 25, the Football Zebras podcast, our 25-minute roundtable discussion on officiating. This week from the Football Zebras crew, I have Chris Soibert and Pat Weber, and I'm Ben Ostro. So we're going to take a look around some of the things we saw over the past weekend and even the past week. We're going to start with a couple of situations in a couple of games where we saw either quick whistles or inadvertent whistles or however we want to, erroneous whistles as it's now referred to in the rule book. So we had multiple situations. Usually these are fairly isolated to once every couple of seasons, maybe once in a season, you know, every other season, but to have multiple ones happening on the same weekend at the NFL level is quite unusual. So we had one situation in the first quarter where the Eagles had a field goal attempt. Ball was well on its way, and we heard whistles while the ball was in flight. Ball ricochets off of the goalpost and is no good. And when they went with that play as being a no good, the field goal was no good and didn't replay the down or anything like that. In New Orleans, we had a situation where on a fumble recovery, there was one official who had from across the field that the recovering player was down, probably a little mix in which body was in there. And so what wound up happening was a touchdown run back was nullified and they had to go back to the spot of the recovery. So yeah, it's probably the bane of the existence of officiating, other than maybe dropping it down, you know, an inadvertent whistle. There's really no way to really control Z that whistle in an equitable manner. But I mean, it happens at all levels, and it even happens up at the NFL.
Yeah, like you said, Ben, the worst thing for an official to have is an inadvertent whistle. But again, sometimes it happens, and it was quite surprising to have a couple in a weekend, actually. I mean, the first thing you have to do whenever this happens and whenever a whistle clearly goes off is you have to admit to it, right? I mean, the last thing you can do is bury it and hope no one heard it, especially in the NFL. The one on the ball in flight is probably not really one, right? Because the officials were, you know, one of the tools that we have is whenever, you know, players are getting together and starting to get close to whether it's an unnecessary roughness or a unsportsmanlike conduct, is you start kind of chirping your whistle a little bit to get them to stop. And that's probably what happened in the case of the flight of the field goal kick. And again, it didn't really affect the players on the field at the time because the ball was already gone. So nothing really to do there. But other than that, yeah, when it comes to line of scrimmage officials sort of ruling on players down, typically it's, you know, where the runner is closest to, that's who the line of scrimmage official goes with. So the far side official in this case blowing it early is probably not ideal. Thankfully, you know, the turnover had already happened, so they didn't eliminate the turnover. They just eliminated sort of the scoop and score.
Yeah, you know, when we start a game, one of the last things we all kind of say as a crew is usually see leather, because the last thing you want is to be blowing your whistle without really seeing that the runner has control of the ball when they're down or when they're forward progress, so you're willing to have stopped.
And most plays kill themselves, right, Pat? I mean, in general, half the plays probably don't even require a whistle per se. And thankfully, you know, we can kind of just let the players sort of kill the play themselves. But I understand the NFL, you know, people are flying at 100 miles a second, right? So they want to kill it, I guess, as fast as they can while still making sure they avoid those inadvertent whistles. But again, probably on the grassroots level, especially all the way down to like high school or even youth, you know, you can certainly delay that whistle as long as you can before you start blowing it.
Yeah, one of the things we always talk about is the play ends the play, not the whistle. So we want to see that play end before we sound our whistles.
And we saw a situation on Monday night several years ago. It was Gene Steratore's crew. The reason I remember that is because, unfortunately, we wrote the headline for the next day to say Steratore crew defeated on Monday night. This is one of our more ominous headlines that we ran. But in that particular situation, it was an erroneous whistle with a pass in flight. And it was a situation where there was some interference from the sideline, and the knee-jerk reaction was to blow the whistle to get control of the situation. And then as soon as the sound emanated out of that whistle, you could almost feel that, you know, the attempt to pull that back, because it's like, not, we got a live play here. And so they sorted it out. They made the pass complete. Even though it was still in the air mostly, but again, took it to its logical conclusion. You can't get replay involved in a situation with sound. So they went with the situation being that the catch was made, because that was the most logical way to determine that, based on trying to determine whistle or the position of the ball at that particular time. Again, it's not easy to sort these things out. It's never anything that you have an equitable resolution to. And then, unfortunately, we stay in the Eagles game, and you know we are looking at these push plays where we're dealing with false starts, offensive offside, or moving the ball. So we have an illegal snap, or some sort of double clutch, and they're detected, not detected. Defense is, you know, coming offside or preceding the snap. And so there's just a whole myriad of difficulty around that particular play. And then we wind up with a situation where a quick whistle nullifies a fumble on a forward progress call. So again, we now take that same principle, and now we look at forward progress, which by its nature is a retroactive call.
Yeah, it almost seems like the football gods are really trying to get rid of the tush push, because every week we see something new come into play when it comes to this sort of, whether it's ruling on forward progress or whether it's, like you said, Ben, all the other sort of difficult things to officiate from a very confined area of players. When, you know, we've talked in previous podcasts of, do we need to start moving officials around just to get a better view of things? And it's funny, I was listening to sports radio today in Detroit, and they were almost wondering, it's like, is a compromise, you know, if you don't completely ban it, do you almost make it a challengeable sort of play where, you know, video replay can get in there and go, oh yeah, they were lined up offsides, or, you know, they false started when, you know, maybe the on-field officials couldn't see it. I can't see that ever happening. But I'm sure the competition committee in the off season is going to keep looking at this as week by week we have something new pop up, as far as whether it's a tight ruling or in this case another incorrect ruling when it came to that forward progress call.
Yeah, this is just not getting any easier for the officiating department, as the Eagles want to run that play over and over, and teams are pulling out every single stop they can to find a way to stop it. And it's just leading to a muddle of different things that's happening every single week.
And that's part of, yeah, I think the what's overwhelming everything is it's always something new coming in. So we're addressing certain situations with false starts, or, you know, a little bit of a movement there that, you know, is, you know, not detected, or, you know, either deliberate or not. You know, a lot of times we do see these deliberate tactics where a guard or a tackle might just rock back ever so slightly. And, you know, usually it would be the guard, because he's shielded by the tackle from the line of scrimmage official. So now you're relying on the umpire, the referee, to see that rocking back from their perspective. And you have everybody just so tightly packed in there. We even said that there was a false start that was called, I believe, where it was the center's hand that moved. And because everybody's so tightly packed, you couldn't tell the difference between all of these players. The thing is that, and I even wrote this on Sunday, which is we could ban the play or come up with all sets of rules that say that you can't do it this way and you can't do it that way. Whatever it is, there's going to be some sort of workaround, because these short yardage situations will always look fairly similar. We've seen these sorts of things before, where it's a, just drive into the line or the over the top situation, where we have a forward progress call, and did the runner pull the ball back before they were contacted, and any number of things that go with that. So in this particular case, it was that quick whistle that, is it a player safety thing that whistle came so quickly? Or, I think that you have the Giants who found a legitimate way to combat the play, which is to say, okay, we're not going to force so much on stopping, but we're going to get that ball out no matter what. We're going to do every effort to get that ball out of their possession. So even if they do make the line the gain, they don't have possession at the end of the down, or they wind up repossessing it behind the spot. So it's going to take a lot more scrutiny. It's going to take a lot more drills on this. And there's going to be a bunch more non-calls or calls that are missed in this, unfortunately, because of this short yardage situation.
I just wonder if the quick whistle came about because they are so hyper-focused and they've been, I wouldn't say beaten down, but I'm sure the officials every week have heard from the officiating department, hey, you have to be on top of this play. And, that's going to cause any official out there just to be so sort of almost wired up, right? Where they want to stop that forward progress at the moment it was stopped, so the Eagles don't get the benefit of the doubt of an extra half a yard. And in this case, it backfired on the Giants, unfortunately. But I mean, that's probably goes a little bit into it of they're just being, directed every week to just look at every little thing, and it's just going to drive them. It's going to drive them crazy as they go forward.
And we also had on Sunday night, we had Chris Collinsworth late in the game. It was right before the 2-minute warning. The Steelers didn't have a timeout, so therefore they had no ability to challenge. And there was a touchdown, or it was called an incomplete pass, and replay assist jumped in and saw that there was objective evidence that there was a catch and therefore a touchdown, which then spurred the controversy of, when do you let replay come in? And, there's some pretty, pretty tight protocols on it. They have until 20 seconds on the play clock. It's got to be something where it's objective and not something where they have to like shuttle back and forth and say, well, did we get it? Did we get it? Where's the knee? Where's that? It's got to be very clear on one pass of the video that you have a call. And, in a situation like that, if it was a little more complicated, if we're like looking at the sideline and threading the sideline, then that's not going to replay assist. And the Steelers don't get the touchdown. So on one hand, you have the crowd that says, well, thank you for, making something that we can see right, make it right, even though the team doesn't have the timeouts. And then on the other end is, well, they wasted their timeouts, and so therefore the challenges go with it. But all in all, this idea of replay assist was the compromise to the ever-present sky judge, and I think it's working pretty well. I mean, with anything, there's going to be an error rate, but it seems to be pretty low, and it seems to be helping out in the situations when it needs to be helping out.
Yeah, I think that play last night is a tough play live because it's a pass situation and the ball ends up on the ground. It's very easy to call incomplete, but replay assist can easily count the steps and see how many steps he got down with control, and you get that time element for the football act. And it's definitely would not be a good look if the Steelers don't get a touchdown that they should have had just because they had to use their timeouts to stop the clock. and that's definitely a good situation to replay assist, especially when it is that objective. And kind of in the same vein, I do think it is working out very well because replay assist has been quick on the clear calls, and it makes the game move efficiently. Whereas if you look at college football, where the replay booth does stop for everything that's reviewable, you get a lot of start, stop, and choppy games, and it affects game length a lot. When they're doing their jobs and getting the plays right, but it just seems to slow down the game a lot at times.
And maybe this is an instance, again, we've seen, whether it's the UFL or other leagues where they kind of bring you into the command center or the replay booth a little bit to get an idea of what they see. And I think we all kind of agree the NFL probably won't go there anytime soon, even though I think fans would A, be educated, and B, be refreshed by how much thought the replay officials and, the command centers put into these decisions. It might just give some transparency as to why they ruled on that quickly, right? Where they could clearly see that it was a catch. If they can make that decision in the amount of time needed, I'm with Pat. You got to get the call right if you can do it, even if they are out of timeouts. But again, as you alluded to, Ben, where is that sort of dividing line between replay assist getting involved and them saying, well, there might not be enough here, this requires a full challenge? And again, any transparency, I think, from the NFL now is probably a good thing. But I guess I just don't see that sort of transparency coming anytime soon, unless, again, it gives them more ratings.
And we'll finish off with some news that hit during the week from the SEC. Referee Ken Williamson, who was working the Auburn-Georgia game earlier this month, apparently there were 11 complaints from the coaches on specific plays as far as the disagreement on what was called. And sources that it was originally reported by Yellowhammer, and their sources said, Yellowhammer News said that their sources said 9 of those 11 complaints were determined to be valid. So again, the crew has a bad game, but now we have an official that has been suspended indefinitely by the SEC, or permanently, I guess is their words. We haven't seen any real statement that lines out what the mistakes are or anything like that. But, this puts us down a slippery slope of, if we have a bad game here, even if it's a high profile game, are we going to just make officials scared of any repercussions? I mean, that's not to say that there shouldn't be repercussions when you have a sizable number of dings in the season or over the course of a few weeks, but suspensions just don't seem to work.
Yeah, we all have bad games. We've all been there. I know Terry McCauley in his comments noted that his crew had a bad game 1 year and they knew they're having a bad game and they end up grading out for the whole season as the best crew. But for someone who's been a longtime official in one of the best conferences in college football and has gotten many big assignments because he grades out well, it just seems like with the way that game was handled and the discipline handled, that it goes beyond just simple grading how you grade out for like a game or a season. I know a lot of fans believe there's no accountability in officiating, but we all know, anyone who's involved knows, there is accountability. There are plenty of people who don't grade out well and don't get the same assignments the next year. And if Williamson was slipping and he wasn't grading out well, it would make sense if at the end of the season he didn't grade enough to get a contract for the next year. But to have one game where they have don't have a good game, and all of a sudden an AD is not happy and now he's out of a job, it just seems like there's something more beyond just simply grading.
Yeah, there has to be more here than we see, because we've seen officiating crews have a week off because of a bad game, right? Or a certain position official being off for a week, but not essentially being fired mid-season. So there has to be more going on behind the scenes that happened that, quite frankly, the SEC should comment on, especially with this being out there. Because as Pat said, we all know if you don't do a good job, you are not going to be rehired or given high level assignments. And Ken was clearly one of the predominant officials in the SEC for quite a while until this basically happened. And I found it to be quite shocking and something that's pretty much unprecedented when it comes to a conference dealing with, you know, an official in that sort of capacity. And that kind of brings you back to the whole debate of should there even be conference officials or should there be an overarching sort of NCAA officiating pool where they just send officials to different conferences where they have no alliance, right, or allegiance, so to say. Kind of like, you know, basketball does that still a little bit too, but I think less so. But yeah, this opens up a whole can of worms of should they redo sort of the way they assign officials in the NCAA football, you know, and it's just, again, it was shocking to me that you would fire someone mid-season for one bad game.
It also feels a little bit different because while the referee is absolutely the crew chief and, you know, responsible for how the crew handles the game, I know Ken may have missed a couple of calls, but, you know, the referee is not making all these calls or all these mistakes, and to have the referee singled out like that instead of the whole crew being sat for a week if the whole crew had a bad game just feels different on its own as well.
Right, and that's where you start to wonder, yeah, what else is behind this? Because NFL didn't pull a plug on an official midseason, with the exception of Hugo Cruz, but from the entire from the 60s on, they did not let an official go. I think we also found one AFL official early on that was let go in the middle of the season, and that's it. Between 1960 and present, that's the only time we saw a mid-season firing. And again, with Hugo Cruz, it was, as we were told at the time when we broke the news, it was a sustained period of time where there were significant downgrades. So, yeah, there was an expectation that he was not going to make it beyond the season, but it was the shocker that he was let go mid-season. And before they even did that, they were bouncing him around to different crews, which also really doesn't help with any sort of continuity as well. So we can relitigate that whole situation there, but that was the only time that the NFL has pulled the plug mid-season. And now we are seeing that with this past season, they let three officials that they felt were underperforming, they let them go. I was even told that it could have been more, but it was the first year for Ramon George at vice president of officiating. And I think that they wanted to kind of keep it, three was a good number, but, I guess a few others got some notices in their email box to keep themselves in shape for the season. So that's, in that case, it's not so much, one game is going to sink you, but it's more of a sustained be on your, on your keys, be focused and all that. But you don't bench a player for one bad game. You don't fire a coach for one bad game. There has to be some sort of pattern where it's consistent of a consistent nature before you take that kind of action. So, and in that case, there's plenty of other teams for a player or a coach to go to. With the officials, there is only one team up at the pro level. And that wraps up another edition of the First and 25 podcast. Next week, we're going to be taking a look at high school playoff assignments. So we have a survey up on the Football Zebras page. And if you are a high school official, we'd like to know a little bit about what your state association and how locally you handle your playoff assignments. And we'll add some of the comments to the conversation next week. So we're going to be taking a look at that as playoff football ramps up on Friday nights. And we will be dropping a new episode every Tuesday throughout the season. So please share this, get the word out. and we're appointment listening during your lunch break. You can listen on our website or find us and favorite us on your preferred podcasting platform. I'm Ben Ostro for Chris Soybert and Pat Weber. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.